Before I begin, let me bring you greetings from our sisters and brothers in the First Baptist Church in Matanzas, Cuba, where I preached 2 weeks ago, and from the Central Baptist Church in Bogota, Colombia, where I visited and worshipped last Sunday. And this beautiful new icon of St. Paul was painted by a member of that church in Cuba, and it is a gift from their church to our church. And they already use Spanish translations of a number of prayers from our liturgy, and they are hoping that this icon can contribute further to a relationship of mutual sharing and encouragement. Because, after all, Baptist churches that would welcome the gift of an icon are somewhat rare, and we need to stick together even if we are on opposite sides of the world. So I'm going to pass it around so you can have a look at it. My experience of travelling in Mexico, Cuba and Colombia over recent weeks inevitably impacted on the way that I have been hearing the news and on the way I heard our readings tonight. One of the dominant stories in the news this week has been the plight of refugees trying to get into Europe. And the images of the little boy who drowned have jolted us towards facing the reality of what is going on in these desperate situations. And of course, our own country here is also facing big questions over our response to refugees and asylum seekers. And in northern Mexico, there is also a huge crisis with tens of thousands of people from Mexico and Central America, many of them unaccompanied children. Arriving at the border of the USA and finding themselves faced with a huge fence that is intended to keep them out. People are no longer fleeing Cuba with the same desperation that they were a couple of decades ago when the collapse of the Soviet Union left Cuba literally starving, but there are still people who are wanting to leave there too. Our readings tonight speak into these situations in a number of ways, and I'm only going to be able to scratch the surface. In particular, they raise the question of our willingness to love our neighbours and show genuine hospitality towards those neighbours who we regard as strangers, and whether we really have faith in God and in God's ways that is able to be expressed in concrete actions when we are approached by needy strangers. But I want to approach that question by first looking at a related issue that also features strongly in tonight's readings, and that is our attitudes more generally to wealth and poverty. Our first reading from the book of Proverbs and our second from the letter of James both speak quite directly about the importance of not discriminating against the poor. And yet much of the immigration policy of our nation is grounded quite deliberately in discrimination against the poor. The immigrants that we want are those who can bring some wealth with them and who have the capacity to generate more wealth on arrival. And there are means tests to determine the desirability of various immigrants. And economic factors are one of the biggest determinants, just after whether you've ever been involved in terrorism or something like that. And although the countries, there are countries in Latin America that are much poorer than the ones I was visiting, but there were still some confronting scenes of poverty where I was. I saw people sleeping in the streets and eating from rubbish bins. And although I can see such things here too, it was a more constant and close at hand experience there. Bogota is a city which is now emerging from decades of violence and poverty and is actually becoming one of the more successful economies in Latin America. And it's a much more modern and obviously prosperous place than most South American cities. But there are still huge numbers of internally displaced people in Colombia without access to homes or adequate resources. One afternoon there, I was participating in a bike tour of the city, and we stopped at some street food stalls in a very nice inner city garden area. And as we casually ate our arepas and fruit salads, every container that we tossed into the rubbish bin was immediately pulled out again by a hungry man who would then clean it out much more thoroughly before disposing of it again. The Syrophoenician woman's words in our gospel reading about even the dogs getting to eat the crumbs that fall from the children's table seemed painfully close to home in that moment. Somehow for me, though, it was seeing similar extreme examples of poverty in my couple of days in the USA that was the more disturbing. On most levels, the USA is a lot more like home for me. And to most of the rest of the world, especially the poorer developing nations, the USA appears to be the promised land of endless wealth and opportunity. But frankly, I would much rather be poor in Colombia, Cuba, or Mexico than in the USA. In Colombia and Cuba especially, although there is still a lot of poverty, the situation is massively improved on what it was a couple of decades ago. And a situation of such improvement is much more hopeful for the poor than the systemic exclusion of the poor that characterises the social policies of both Australia and the USA. I was also reminded during this trip of just how difficult it is to make real comparisons and judgments about wealth and poverty, because our perceptions are so heavily influenced by the current norms of our own contexts. In Mexico, I stayed for 4 nights in the home of my friend Elvira. Elvira is quite middle class by most measures. She's tertiary educated, she has a stable job or four, and has recently travelled overseas. But her house and all the other houses in her neighbourhood would be looked down on by the Australian middle class as substandard hovels. It's perfectly comfortable and livable, but with an outside kitchen, a toilet that is flushed with a bucket, bare concrete floors, and a boiler that has to be lit in advance if you want a warm shower, it's not going to make the pages of Better Homes and Gardens. Most Australians would regard that as a form of poverty. But in Elvira's home, they eat and drink well, they laugh and dance a lot, and the whole village seems to be characterised by a rich and generous family and community life that is anything but poor by comparison with the obsessively private and isolated lives of so many Australians. How do you compare these things? And in Cuba too. There, my friends live on monthly wages that are unimaginably low by Australian standards, but housing, healthcare, and education are free. How do you compare? These things are not simple, and yet we can't hide behind that complexity and use it as an excuse to turn our backs when desperate peoples fleeing extreme dangers come knocking on the gates at our borders. If you thought it was legitimate to pluck verses of scripture out of context to justify anything you liked, then in a line of tonight's gospel reading, you could find words from Jesus himself that could easily justify our nation's current policy on asylum seekers and border protection. Jesus says, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." This is exactly what most people think, what most people vote for, and what most people believe our stance towards other people in need should be based on. You hear various other versions of it. Charity begins at home. You have to look after your own first. Secure Australian jobs first. Put your family first, etc., etc. the main reason that both major political parties in this country maintain such hostile border protection and immigration policies is that the majority of Australian voters firmly believe that we have to protect and secure our own interests and well-being before we worry about the welfare of outsiders. We will accept immigrants who will bring money and expertise with them and so contribute to raising our standard of living. But we don't want to accept those who might be a drain on our resources. Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Donald Trump is appealing to the same sentiments in his bid for the American presidency when he says that Mexico is not sending its best people to the US borders, but its violent, its criminal, and its poverty-stricken people. Actually, Mexico is not sending anyone, but desperate people, many of whom have had their lives and communities torn apart by the drug cartels that are sustained by American demand, are fleeing the violence and looking for hope and opportunity. But the walls and fences grow higher and the border protection forces grow more militant. Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take food and the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Now, although these words come from Jesus, the whole point of recording them is to show that Jesus promptly renounced them. Different scholars and preachers explain that in different ways. Some are comfortable with the idea that the Syrophoenician woman's words opened Jesus' eyes and he repented on the spot. Others say that Jesus was always playfully mocking the very principle that he was expressing and that it was always his intention to express it for the purpose of exposing its ungodliness and turning it on its head. But however you think the dynamic worked in that moment, the plain fact is that Jesus does not end up championing the idea that we can ignore the plight of others until we have secured the prosperity of those on our side of the border or the social divide. At the conclusion of this story, it is clear that Jesus accepts that there are no borders to God's love or God's concern for the well-being of others. The Apostle James, in our other reading, brings this same question home to our church gatherings. If a person with gold rings and in fine clothes comes into your assembly, and if a poor person in dirty clothes also comes in, and you take notice of the one wearing the fine clothes and say, "Here, have a seat, here, please," and to the one who is poor you say, "Stand over there," have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? It's important that we hear the local specifics of this. It is no use us sitting back and criticising the national government for its lack of hospitality if we are not putting generous hospitality into practice in the context of our own homes and our own church community. James goes on to describe as a royal law the command to love your neighbour as yourself. And he suggests that acts of partiality in whom we will or won't welcome with generosity and joy are failures to follow the law of God just as serious as adultery or murder. Loving your neighbour, be they friend or stranger, as yourself, is so close to the heart of God and so fundamental to the ways and expectations of God that picking and choosing who we will and won't love is, according to James, as serious a breach of God's law as the things that we jail people for. But the Apostle James goes further than this too, and he takes it right to the heart of our theology, right to the heart of the good news, to the heart of our concept of faith. In a passage that completely infuriated the great reformer Martin Luther, James says, What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says, go in peace, keep warm and eat your fill, and yet you do not supply their bodily needs, what good is that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead. But I think that we often make the same mistake that I think Luther made, and hear that passage as playing faith and works off against each other and choosing for one over and against the other. But I don't think that's what James is saying. Rather, James is asking us to see that there is no such thing as a faith that doesn't affect our behaviour and our relationships. The way that we behave and treat others demonstrates the truth about what we are putting our faith in. If we cling to the idea that it is not right to offer the children's food to others, and that we should therefore close our borders and our doors and secure our own well-being first, we are demonstrating that our faith is really being invested in economic protection and in the maintenance of a privileged in-group. By our actions, we demonstrate that we believe that these are the things that will save us. But if we willingly risk our own prosperity to welcome and feed needy others, then it is clear that we have put our trust in the promises of God, that fullness of life is to be found in giving it away for the life of the world. There are plenty of people who claim to be putting their faith in Jesus for the salvation of their souls after death, but who simultaneously demonstrate by their actions that they do not have any faith that following the teachings of Jesus would be a healthy and fulfilling way to live life in the here and now. They have much more faith in money, possessions, armies, and border protection forces to secure their lives in the here and now. But neither the Apostle James nor Jesus himself give any support to such an artificial and misguided distinction. A week before I went away, I received an email from a Canadian pastor who regularly visits the same church that I was going to visit in Cuba. And he was sending me some travel advice because I was a first-timer. I think he thought that perhaps it was my first time travelling outside the wealthy West at all. But there was a line in his advice that stuck in my head. Speaking of our mutual friends who were to be my hosts in Cuba, he said, I would trust Orestes and Wanda with my life. You can too. Whatever they tell you, do it. That's a pretty perfect description of faith as the Apostle James is depicting it. You can trust Jesus with your life. Whatever he tells you, do it. You either put your trust in what Jesus tells you to do to save your life for a life worth living, or you continue to put your faith in something else, in idols and privileges. And as frightening as that certainly can be, at its heart, it is stunningly good news. It is the promise that God has now invited all the children to eat at the one table. It is the promise that God wants the absolute best for you and yours and everyone else. And that God has shown us the way into all the fullness of life. It is the promise that your life is not measured by the sum of your possessions, but by the image of God that has been given you freely, and which, when given the freedom, will express itself in love without boundaries and gracious hospitality without borders. It is the promise that when we gather at this table, at the table of our risen Lord, none of us is relegated to picking up crumbs underneath, but all of us are invited to eat and drink of the best, and to go into all the world with our faith in the ways of the one who gives his life for the life of the world.